Good morning, everyone. My name's Joanna, and I am an alcoholic. And I emphasize that usually when I introduce myself that I am an alcoholic, because when I came into AA in August of 2006, I did not know I was an alcoholic. My idea of an alcoholic was somebody like Clancy, and I told Clancy that, somebody standing on a street corner in a brown with a brown paper sack and a trench coat. That was my idea of an alcoholic. I didn't wake up in the morning with a drink. I spaced out my DUIs. I had a total of three of them, but I was pulled over for four of them in lifetime. But I spaced out my DUIs about every 8 years. So in that course of those 8 years, I would forget about what I had gone through before. I discovered that my sobriety date is August the 18th of 2006. I have a wonderful sponsor that I love dearly. She has a sponsor, and I have ladies that I sponsor. My home group is on Monday nights here at the Howe Place, the Turning Point group at 8 o'clock, and I love my home group. I want to read something that was recently sent over to me, and this is what AA is teaching me to try to become. And it's a poem called A Life That Matters. Live a life that matters. Ready or not, someday it will all come to an end. There will be no more sunrises, no minutes, hours, or days. All the things you collected, whether treasured or forgotten, will pass to someone else. Your wealth, fame, and temporal power will shrivel to irrelevance. It will not matter what you owned or what you owed. Your grudges, resentments, frustrations, and jealousies will finally disappear. So too, your hopes, ambitions, plans, and to-do list will expire. The wins and losses that once seemed so important will fade away. It won't matter where you came from or on what side of the tracks you lived at the end. It won't matter whether you were beautiful or brilliant. Even your gender and skin color will be irrelevant. So what will matter? How will the value of your days be measured? What will matter is not what you bought, but what you built. Not what you got, but what you gave. What will matter is not your success, but your significance. What will matter is not what you learned, but what you taught. What will matter is every act of integrity, compassion, courage, and sacrifice that enriched, empowered, and encouraged others to emulate your example. What will matter is not your competence, but your character. What will matter is not how many people you know, but how many will feel a lasting loss when you're gone. What will matter is not your memories, but the memories that live in those who loved you. What will matter is how long you will be remembered, but by whom and for what. Living a life that matters doesn't happen by accident. It's not a matter of circumstance, but of choice. Choose to live a life that matters. And I love this. When this was emailed over to me and it was going to be read at a friend of mine's funeral, I said, that's what AA gives me. AA has given me the desire to want to be somebody that I've never been before, somebody that I didn't feel that I could ever be. And today, AA is a design for living. Like I said, I grew up down in Macon, Georgia, in kindergarten, right before kindergarten, my parents moved to Greensboro, Georgia, and we lived there for 4 years, and the summer of third grade, my parents divorced. My father was an alcoholic. Even though I never really saw my father drink that I can remember as of yet, I do remember, I'm starting to remember a lot of arguing, a lot of fighting. My bedroom was upstairs in the old house. I spent a lot of time in a walk-in closet in that bedroom. Eventually, I moved my dollhouse in there. I moved all my dolls in there, and I pretty much lived in that walk-in closet, especially when they were fighting. My parents divorced in the summer of third grade, and my mother and my brother and I moved to Atlanta. And shortly thereafter, my mom worked for a large company here in Atlanta. Shortly thereafter, my mother started going to law school at night. She went to law school three nights a week, and she worked full time. After my parents divorced, my mom said some things to me that I never really understood. I do understand it today because God has revealed it to me, but I was told things like, you'll never amount to anything, you were a mistake, you should have never been born. And what I found out recently from my older sister is some of those were the things that my father, in a drunken alcoholic rage, would say to my mother the entire time that they were married. So I understand a little bit more today than I did 6 months ago and a few years ago. I am praying and asking God to reveal to me the truth behind my emotions and my actions. And God has revealed things to me through dreams. God has revealed things to me through people sharing in meetings. And through prayer and meditation, God is revealing a lot to me. And I'm very grateful for that. I was a great kid. I was a straight A student. I mean, I was a good kid. I sought the approval of my mother up until probably the last 5 years of her life. And because my parents were divorced, I was a daddy's little girl, so the nurturing I got from my father, daddy would call us, his initial promise was that he'd be up every 2 weeks. Well, daddy didn't get sober till 1982, so he would call us and tell us he was coming up on a particular Saturday, and that Saturday would come and go, and daddy never made it. And as an alcoholic, I understand why Dad never made it, because I didn't make it to a whole lot of things myself in life. And that went on through my entire elementary school and high school. My father got sober when I was 18 and so we saw Daddy maybe 3 or 4 times a year. And I remember I would call Daddy and I'd be crying and ask Daddy why Mom would say the things that she would say to me, and why she blamed me for the divorce, and why she said she wished I would have never been born and I was a mistake and all these things. And looking back at it, my father knew that a lot of that stuff was things he had said to her. He never told me that. It was my sister, like I said, that told me that recently. But he would try to comfort me and tell me that those things weren't true and that my mom loved me and everything. But as a child growing up, you don't really understand that. You don't, you become truly what you are told you are. And that's exactly what I did. In the summer of ninth grade, I went down to visit my father and was going to spend 2 weeks with him. It was the first time I'd been there to spend a period of time. Actually, it was the first time I'd been there since my parents divorced, because my father remarried. And I had run into some girls at the University of Georgia cheerleading camp from elementary school. And so I got in their phone numbers and I went down to visit my dad for 2 weeks. And I was invited to a party. And a guy at that party asked if he could make me a Coca-Cola. At this stage in my life, you guys, it was the summer of ninth grade, but I was a very, very naive teenager. I was a virgin. I knew nothing about drugs. Knew that the only people in my high school, the quote-unquote freaks, smoked marijuana. That was the extent of the drugs at my high school. And so a guy asked to make me a Coca-Cola, and he put the date rape drug in it. He asked me if I wanted to step outside on the back patio, and I did. We were the only people out on that back patio, and I drank that Coca-Cola, and I fell to my knees, and he carried me to another apartment where he proceeded to rape me. What I couldn't understand at that time was I was an athlete. I was in very good shape, and I couldn't understand why I could not move my muscles. I was paralyzed but awake, and I later learned what exactly the drug that had been given to me. But I did what many, many people that are involved in sexual assault do. I didn't tell anybody except my best girlfriend and my brother. And I made my brother swear that he would not tell Mom. And the reason I didn't tell my mother, unfortunately, was because I didn't have a close relationship with my mom. I didn't tell a counselor. This is my part. When I did my fifth step, this was my part. I did not tell anyone what happened to me, and I started using drugs. It started out slowly at first. It started out with marijuana, then eventually, a year or two later, Quaaludes, and then when I was 19, cocaine. I really didn't start drinking until a couple of years later, but I had other substances, especially the Quaaludes, that were helping to numb those feelings. I blamed myself. I can remember at that stage of my life, I would walk in front of a mirror and I would look at myself and call myself horrific names. And I went on through to my mother. I started getting in a little bit of trouble here in Atlanta, not with the law yet, but with skipping school and things like that. So my mother moved me out to Bartow County, to Cartersville. And out in Cartersville, there were things going on that I had never been exposed to at the high school I went to in DeKalb County. And I got mixed up with the wrong crowd. When I was 17, I was facing 40 years for four counts of forgery in the second degree. I went to court and I pleaded the First Offenders Act, and I was put on 5 years probation, restitution for the checks and community service and all that. And shortly thereafter, a few months later, I violated probation on the First Offenders Act. And now I was facing the 40 years and a felony record. So I stayed in the Bartow County Jail, and I asked to meet with the judge the day before my revocation of probation hearing. And I told the judge, he was the only other person I had told at that time that I was raped. And I told him Atlanta was my home and that I really wanted to go back home, but that I would do anything to keep from having a felony record. So Judge White sent me to a drug rehab facility in downtown Atlanta near Techwood Homes, and it was called Reality House. Now, unfortunately, it was not a 12-step program. It was a hardcore therapeutic rehabilitation center where they would sit you in the center of the group and they would break you down. I was the only woman at that time in my life, I was 17, that had not prostituted myself. I had not shot dope. There were a lot of things that I had not done that all the people in this facility had done. And so I was really one that got in that group a lot. And but I did complete that program. And I got out of the program, and Judge White granted for me to leave Bartow County and move back to Atlanta, which I did. And at this stage of the game, I'm on, you know, 4.5 more years of probation on the First Offenders Act. But I learned how to manipulate that system. I quit doing the drug, quit doing the Quaaludes, and by this time, it was the early 80s, I discovered cocaine. And cocaine, and I got into the bar business too at the age of 18. And cocaine took me to places that I'm not proud of. I associated with some very dangerous people. If I would have been caught for some of the things that I did, I would still be in prison today. And but I loved it. I have to say that I loved it. And during that time, I was in the bar business. I also I became a bartender. And I loved alcohol. I gave up the Quaaludes. I gave up the marijuana, but I replaced it with something else, and that was cocaine and alcohol. And at the age of 25, by now I had gotten one DUI. At the age of 25, I went out to California to work a job for a couple of weeks. And whenever I would travel, I wouldn't do anything. I wouldn't drink or do anything. And while I was out there, a woman that I met asked me if I wanted, on my day off, if I wanted to go and hang out with her, and I did. And so we went over to visit a friend of hers. And the guy asked if, you know, I'd like to do a line. And I was like, sure, you know. And I did two lines, and about 15 minutes later, and it was the Santa Monica Police Department. And obviously that home was under surveillance. Here comes a face they'd never seen before, and I'm sure I was the person they thought they were looking for. And I got arrested in Santa Monica, California. My older brother lives in LA. He was out of town in India at the time. I'm thousands of miles away from home and no way to get out of jail. And so I'd met an attorney a couple of nights before at a party that I had bartended at, and I was supposed to have dinner with him a couple of nights later, and I wasn't, you know, he called the people that I was working for and they told him that I was arrested and it was drug related and they weren't having anything to do with me. I mean, these were professional people that were very affluent in Los Angeles, and they were not getting me out of jail for under the influence of controlled substance. So he bailed me out. And I got back to Atlanta, and you know, I don't even remember his name, but he made a suggestion to me at that time, and that suggestion was a 12-step program, Cocaine Anonymous. Because he asked me, you know, if I used, I said, oh yes. He said, but you haven't when you've been here. And I said, oh no, I'm working, you know, no. And so he suggested that to me. So I came back to Atlanta and I got involved in 1989 in Cocaine Anonymous at the age of 25. And I was on the committee for the first Georgia Regional Cocaine Anonymous Convention. I worked steps 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And a little over a year later, started not going to as many meetings, stopped calling my sponsor, didn't finish the steps, and eventually I no longer went to any meetings anymore. And it didn't start out fast, you guys, but I will tell you what I did, the same thing I did before. I stopped doing coke and started increasing alcohol. And one thing that my sponsor pointed out to me not too long ago is there were other substances I used in my life. And I could make the decision to quit, and I quit. I could not make that decision with alcohol. I never could make that decision with alcohol. I always went back to alcohol when I would stop other things. And that qualifies me as an alcoholic, along with a whole lot of other things that I'll tell you guys. But so about a year into, shortly after a year being in Cocaine Anonymous, I never went to meetings anymore. And I want to say that from 1990 to 2006, not one time did the thought of a 12-step program ever cross my mind. Not once. Now, when I would read the Big Book back when I was 25, I don't believe at that time in my life I had crossed the line with alcohol yet. When I would read the Big Book and it would talk about alcohol, I could relate with other substances, but not yet with alcohol. And I didn't go to any Big Book studies and things like that at that time. I was going to meetings at a treatment center. And that treatment center, you know, most of those people in those groups, a lot of those people in the meetings were in treatment. They didn't want to be there. They wanted to use more. So I wasn't listening much to the solution. I was listening to a bunch of folks that didn't want to be there, that wanted to use, and they were romancing the alcohol and the drugs. And I'd get out of there and want to use more than before I went in. And, you know, so I am selective about the groups I go to today also. And it's because I try to live in the solution today. And I need to surround myself around the solution, because I lived in the problem for 27 years and I don't want to live there anymore. After I got out of Cocaine Anonymous, I spaced them out about every 8 years, so I got another DUI. And I got a total of 3 DUIs from 21 to 42. 3 DUIs. I spaced them out about every 8 years. And during those 8 years, like I said earlier, I would forget what I had gone through. Now, I did not forget when I would wake up in the morning, the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I wouldn't forget that, because I did things the night before that I would never do today, and I only did under the influence of alcohol and drugs. And by that evening, the guilt and the shame was eating me up, and I would drink again. An area of the doctor's opinion where it talks about after we have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving. When I read that paragraph, I believe it's on page XXVIII, when I read that paragraph, I related that to the fact that I would drive to work every morning and I would swear I wasn't going to drink that night. I was not going to drink. I'd taken some hamburger meat out. I was going to make a meatloaf. I was going to take a bubble bath. I was going to do some laundry. I was going to take care of myself that night. But by 6:30, you guys, I'd be in the same bar that I was in the night before, doing the same thing over and over. And I did this, you guys, my entire life. My entire life. Because I didn't drink at home. I didn't keep alcohol at home. That's another thing on page 31 where it talks about, here are some of the methods we have tried. I've tried 11 of those things. And the only reason I didn't try scotch or brandy, because I didn't drink scotch or brandy. I drank Jägermeister. And Jägermeister wasn't in existence when the book was written. You know what I mean? But I want to talk about that, you guys. I remember about 7 years before someone bought me a shot of Jägermeister. And I literally, when I took a sip, when I went like that, it was all I could do to keep from throwing up. And I looked at my quote unquote friends and I said, how can you drink that stuff? Well, the last 3 or 4 years of my drinking, that was all that I drank. Jägermeister, and I would drink anywhere between 6 to 10 shots a night and 6 to 10 beers. And that would only be from 6:30 until 9:30 or 10:30 at night, I would consume that amount of alcohol. And so I was no longer socially drinking. I was no longer, you know, my aunt can have one or two glasses of wine. My cousins can drink the same way. I was no longer drinking sociably anymore. I was drinking for the effect produced by alcohol. So when I read the doctor's opinion in the chapter more about alcoholism in 2006, after my first beginner's meeting, I could relate this time. I could relate. I was drinking for the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while we admit it is injurious, we cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Well, I didn't associate with anybody that didn't drink like me. I didn't go to activities that did not allow me to pull a cooler with a big bottle of Jägermeister and a case of beer. Those were the kind of activities that I went to. So, see, that was the only normal life for me because everybody drank like me. You know, when I would get around my family, of course I wouldn't be drinking like that, but I wouldn't get around my family too often because I couldn't do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. And so in August of 2006, I was pulled over again. And I was at a male friend's house up at Lake Lanier. We had gone to dinner that night. It was his birthday. And we had a designated driver. And on the drive home, I realized that I was seeing a side of this guy. He was like a brother to me for 13 years. I was seeing a side of him that I'd never seen. So I called my best male friend and said, "Can you please come pick me up?" And I was starting to give him the address. And this guy grabbed the phone from me and threw it out the window on 400. And got up to the house, and his brother and his nephew, obviously they had seen this side of him many times. They just kept saying, "Joanna, just go downstairs to your bedroom downstairs. We'll keep him away from you. Everything will be fine. When you get up in the morning, just leave." And I was like, okay. And about that time, I had my back turned to the front door. He shot a gun. He went inside the house. He shot a gun. And I had my back turned to him, so I didn't know where he shot the gun. It sounded like he shot it at me. It was up on the Chesapeake Channel of Lake Lanier. It sounded like a cannon. I jumped in my car, and I left the house that night in Lumpkin County, driving to Kennesaw. And I got probably 15 miles down the road. I didn't realize a police officer had been following me for about 5 miles. And about that time, the lights turned on. Blue lights turned on, and I was pulled over for what would have been my fourth DUI in lifetime. And that night in the Dawsonville jail, I prayed. And I've prayed before. I've been to jail 8 times, and I've prayed before. But I prayed, and I asked God, "Please help me. I'm too old, and I'm too tired to go down this road again," was what I said. And about that time, God showed me the last 27 years of my life in active addiction. But he didn't show me the good times. He showed me all the times that I'd gotten in trouble, all the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. He showed it to me in a slow-moving movie. And I remember saying, "Oh my God, I've got to quit drinking." Still not knowing that I was an alcoholic, but I saw the destruction that alcohol and drugs had caused in my life and had not seen it before. And for me, the desire for alcohol left that night. That's not common, but it did leave me that night. Doesn't mean that I haven't wanted to take a drink or thought about taking a drink, going through some of the difficult things that I've been through in the last 6 years, but the desire for it, the craving for it, was gone. And a male friend of mine had been inviting me to the Turning Point group for 3 years. He never told me I was an alcoholic. He would come and meet me. "Come meet me, have a few beers. You know, I'm just having a few beers." You know, all this crap. He'd come and he would sit there with me, and he would sit and he would talk about what he had learned in AA and how he had changed. And he would ask me if I ever wanted to come to a meeting, he would bring me. He never told me I was an alcoholic. So I called him and I told him what happened. He goes, "You want to go to that Monday night meeting with me?" And I said, "Yes." And I sat in the beginner's room, and this time I heard what I needed to hear. I heard people talking about what my life was like. I heard people sharing that they had done similar things. I heard them talking about the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And then I heard the people back in the beginner's room that had been around for a month, 6 months, 6 years, 20 years, sharing the solution, sharing about how their life had changed, about how happy they were, about the adversities that they had been through in recovery. and that how the people in AA were there with them. And I remember thinking in that meeting, I want what they have. I did not want what they have when I had when I was 25, but this time I wanted what they had. And as Ralph always says, if you want what the three or four men told him first came in, if you want what we have, you will do what we did. And somebody bought me a big book, and they suggested that within the first couple of nights, someone had heard that story about the man shooting the gun at me, because I was furious. I thought that was the worst night of my life, that what had happened. And I wanted to get revenge, to be honest with you. And I remember sharing that in the beginner's meeting, and the man took me to the back of the book about resentment. And he said, I would highly suggest that you pray for this man. And I said to him, I cannot or will not pray for him. And he said to me, if you don't pray for him, you will drink again or you will die. That was pretty much what he said. And so I started praying. And what I said in the beginning wasn't real pretty, the things that I said when I was praying, because I did not have a relationship with God at the time, you know. But eventually, and it was within about 2 weeks, the stuff that was coming out of my mouth was unreal. I mean, I started praying things for this man that I could not believe that I was praying. And I have no resentment today against this guy. I realized that that was the best night of my life. It was a God moment for me. And it took what it took for me to be where I'm at today. And so I got a sponsor shortly thereafter, and she was a wonderful woman. I got a sponsor that was just like me in her personality. She called a spade, and I loved that about her. I loved it because I was just like that. I could chew you up and spit you out. And even when, you know, there are times that people, I believe, deserve that, you know. But the sponsor that I have today has taught me how to be assertive in a respectful way. I can say the same thing with love and respect and check my motives, and I get so much freedom from that. Because when I came into the rooms, I had no boundaries. I was a doormat and had been a doormat my entire life. And so I didn't start at 3 years sober. I yelled at the woman that saved my life. She saved my life. And I yelled at her in my front yard. And that led me to the woman that I have today. And the woman that I have today, whenever I would ask her anything, the first question she would ask me is, have you prayed about it? And I had not. So she asked me that so many times that eventually I began to pray first. And then I began to pray again and again and again. And then I would take some quiet time and I would meditate over it. And then I began finding that I began calling her less and less to ask her advice or direction in certain areas of my life. And the reason was because God was revealing to me the path that I needed to take. Or I would be in a meeting, I'd be sitting out in the car, and I'd say, God, reveal it to me at this meeting. Speak to me through a brother or sister in recovery at this meeting. And God would. Specifically, that was in the beginning in my spiritual journey, you guys, I tested God, and I tested him for over a year. I'm not proud to say that I did that, but I did. And I'm going to share on a couple of those instances. My first sponsor, she was wonderful. She said, I said, don't shove God down my throat. Please don't shove God down my throat. And she said, do you believe that we believe? And I said, oh, yes, I know that y'all believe. And she said, just believe that we believe. I said, I can do that. I can believe that you believe, but do not shove God down my throat. And it was a process. The spiritual journey has been in seeking for me today. And it's been in seeking in many paths. Even though I went back to the God of my childhood, I also pray for an open mind in other areas, in other belief systems. And a lot has been revealed in the seeking through other paths, especially the Native American path for me. I know the first time when a friend of mine here took me to Cherokee, I knew when I went to the AA convention, I knew that I was supposed to be there. And I knew that God was going to show me things there. That was all that I knew. What was going to be shown to me over the next 3 years has been absolutely amazing what God has revealed to me. I pray for things here, maybe at church or at night or in the morning in prayer and meditation. And it's revealed to me in Cherokee, North Carolina, by the sacred fire and in the sacred drum circles. It's absolutely amazing to me, the things that are revealed to me up there in Cherokee. And it's very specific. So it's like absolutely unbelievable. One of those instances, and I'll give you a quick instance. I bought a drum last year at a yard sale. And I knew that I was supposed to find that drum at that yard sale, and I knew I was supposed to take it to Cherokee with me in September. So I did. I took it to Cherokee, I showed it to the elders, and they said, we need to have a ceremony to make the drum come alive, you know, whatever that's called in Native American terms. And so Friday night, we had a spiritual ceremony for this drum. And the water was blessed, and the sage, and the tobacco, and there were about 30 people in this circle. And the elders were there. And before the end of everybody washing this drum down with the sacred water, with the eagle feather, God revealed to me who I was to give the drum to. And so it got back to me, and I said, God has revealed to me that I'm to gift this drum to this little boy. And I pointed to the little boy. And I didn't think anything more about it. You know, God told you, gift it to this young boy right here. I went to bed. The next morning, his mother came to my tent, and she says, I've got to tell you what my son told me last night. I said, what? A year and a half, every day, he had prayed to the Lord that he would be gifted a drum. Now, even before that, he had spoken to one of the elders that was in this circle, and he says, I want to be gifted a drum. And the elder says, will you ask your grandpa, who comes to these events from upstate New York every year, ask your grandpa will buy you a drum, or your mom will buy you a drum. And the little boy says, oh, no, I don't want my grandpa or my mom to buy me a drum. I want to be gifted a drum. And he asked him, well, why do you want to be gifted a drum? He says, because I want to have sacred drum circles with all my friends my age. And so he prayed every day for a year and a half. This elder said to him, pray to the God of your own understanding that you will be gifted a drum. Every day for a year and a half, he prayed to the Lord that he would be gifted a drum. And God spoke to me in that sacred circle that was who I was to gift the drum to. That kind of stuff to me is not coincidence today. They're God moments, and I truly, truly believe that the more that I seek, the more these kind of things will be revealed. I want to tell you another story. I started a job last year that was short-lived, and one of the guys in IT that was training me was a Jehovah Witness, and he began to share with me a story that the first time that he heard God audibly, and this is what happened. He was driving down the road, and there was a black woman walking in the pouring down rain. And God spoke to him and told him to turn around in his car and give that woman his umbrella. He says, but God, that's my only umbrella. I can't do that. So he played around with it for a couple of times. He turned around. He finally turned around and turned back around and gave that woman his umbrella, rolled his window down. And I started to cry when he told me that story, because the first time that I heard God audibly was about 3 years ago, and I'm driving down Wade Green Road in the pouring down rain, and there was a black man walking down the road. And God spoke to me and told me to give that man, to turn around and give that man my mom's Georgia Power golf umbrella. And I said, no, God, that umbrella was my mom's, and it's the only umbrella I have. He said, turn around. And it went a little longer for me. It went all the way down Wade Green Road for me until finally God said, you could go to the thrift store and buy you another umbrella. So I turned around and turned around again, rolled the window down, and handed that man my umbrella. Now, is that a coincidence? That's not a coincidence. It's just not. I don't understand it. And I don't have to understand it. All I try to do today is seek it. Seek that personal relationship with a God of my own understanding. And it's been in the seeking that God has revealed himself to me through, first, through you people. God shows himself to me today through the big book, through other meditations, and I read about between 3 to 5 meditations a day. I do include a Emotions Anonymous meditation, and I also include a Codependency meditation and an Al-Anon meditation, and they have helped me tremendously because I have a whole lot of issues. What has happened to me since 2006, I'm going to be very, very quick on this. I went through a female surgery when I had about a year sober, where I didn't know whether or not I had cancer until I woke up and the oncologist was holding my hand and I did not have cancer. A few months later, my mother passed away in February of 2007, and I was able to be there for her and care for her and bathe her, and I was able to witness the most ultimate spiritual experience. 10 months later, my father died, and I was also able to witness the most ultimate spiritual experience. In February of 2007, a few weeks after my mom died, I called a girlfriend of mine. She said, "I will be at your mother's funeral." My mother's funeral came and went the 1st of March. She wasn't there. About a week later, I got a call from the Charlotte Police Department. Her family had filed a missing persons report. And about a week later, he called me again to tell me they had found her dead, murdered and buried in the backyard of the man that she met on Craigslist. She was that woman that she was in a line of work that I used to be in for a brief period of time. And I remember I was sitting outside the 8111 meeting when I got that call, and I was very, very angry at God. And I told God I was angry. And God revealed to me at that very moment that I had worked for the same escort agency she had worked for in Atlanta, that I left bars with many men that I didn't know the names of, and that all those times he had protected me. And that's what God reminded me. His trial is coming up in April, and I hope that he is prosecuted. He was just recently released out of prison when he found her on Craigslist and the personal ads. She was murdered and buried in his backyard. I've been unable to read the details of it. I'm not ready for that yet, but I'm sure it wasn't the way I want to go today. And let's see, what else? I've been laid off from my job twice in the past 6.5 years. When I came into the program, my home was in foreclosure. I got it out of the foreclosure status. Then I met someone at some meeting somewhere that told me about a program that that Obama had implemented for folks like me that had the fluctuating interest rate, where the interest rate went through the roof. My mortgage payment used to be $1,600 a month, and it is $613 a month now. And that saved my home. I spent about a month completing all the paperwork, sending it in. And I walked through every bit of it scared to death. Every bit of it. That's one of the things that I wanted to talk about, is courage. I have fear today. I have fear today in a lot of things that I do for the first time. But I know that I must walk. I'm going to have fear whether I walk through it or not. So if I put one foot in front of the other and walk through it, I no longer have the fear. It has turned to courage for me, and it's also turned to experience, and this is the sole purpose of it. It has turned to experience for the sole purpose of sharing it with another person in and outside of these rooms. My job, and Debbie, my sponsor, really stresses this with me. My job is to be fit to be of maximum service to God and others. There's some things that girls and ladies and men that I know come to me that I have no experience. I have no children. I've never been married. I don't need to be giving anybody any advice on marital counseling. I've never been married. I'm not a parent. I don't need to be giving anybody any advice on how to parent. But I do know men and women in the program who do have experience, that live in the solution, that I refer these men and women to. But I do have experience with alcoholism and drug addiction. I do have experience in jails, and pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I've got lots of experience in that category. And so for me today, courage is a huge thing, and I prayed for courage for 2 years. And I look back at my journal from 2007, 2008, 2009, and in every entry, and there's only about 10 of them, in every entry, you know, once a month, but in every solitary entry, I was praying and asking God for courage. And I was asking God to help me to walk through life on life's terms. And I was also asking God to reveal to me the truth behind my emotions and my actions. I asked God to reveal to me the truth behind why I yelled at my sponsor in my front yard, and he revealed it to me. I asked God I expect an answer from God today, and God gives me the answers. Sometimes there'll be a situation that I need an answer like quickly. I was going to go down and visit my dad that day for lunch, and there was something that I was really going to tell him, but I need another opinion. I prayed out in the parking lot, God revealed to me who in this 8 a.m. meeting I should talk to. And God did. And it was a man that had about 14 years of sobriety who was also a father. And I spoke to him that morning after the meeting, and I chose not to say what I was going to say to my daddy. Even though what I was going to say, my daddy, every time we would meet or be on the phone, he'd say, I should have been a better father. And I was just going to say, well, daddy, you can start right now. Well, guess what? My daddy died 6 months later. And I'm so grateful I never said that to my daddy, because my daddy lived with the same guilt that this man I spoke to that morning lives with every day. The guilt of the father that he should have been. My daddy lived with that every day. And so I chose from the conversation I had with him not to have that conversation with my daddy. And I'm so grateful I didn't, because my dad died 6 months later. But so my home was in foreclosure. I was able to refinance my home. Oh, I got legitimate with the IRS. I had not existed with the IRS for 25 years. And I heard some woman share about it in a meeting. And I said, and she got legitimate with the IRS. I went up to her afterwards and said, can I get the name of your CPA? Because I knew that I did not want to go into it by myself. And I got legitimate with the IRS. And I was 3 years sober when I did that. I was still living with that fear and that anxiety of not being legitimate like that, you know. And for me today, it's about walking through stuff. I've got to walk through it. Sooner or later, I'm going to have to walk through it. Natalie knows a lot about this. You know, I fell in love in 2011, and you know, my heart was broken. It was broken, but I don't regret what I did. And if I had an opportunity to do it again with the same person, I'd do it again. And about a month before he died, you know, I knew he had been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And I wanted to go down there to see him. And my sponsor made a really good recommendation, and that was that I call his daughter and make sure that he wanted to see me, which I did. And he did want to see me, because there was no closure in our relationship. And I went down there, and when I saw him, there was no more anger, no more pain, no more resentment. There was nothing but forgiveness and love in my heart. And I'm not capable of that, but God is capable of that. So I went and saw him a couple of weeks before his death, and then I went back 2 weeks later for his funeral. And the reason was, God was telling me I needed to go. And my sponsor asked me 3 questions. Are you spiritually fit? I said, yes. Are you emotionally fit? I said, no. To go down there, you know. But I knew that I was spiritually fit, and I knew that God was telling me I needed to go. I didn't know why, but I needed to go. I went back for his funeral, and I know why God was telling me to go. Because I was questioning a lot of things. I was questioning the spiritual principles. I was questioning the program. I was questioning myself. I was questioning a lot of stuff when that relationship ended suddenly. And when I was at his funeral, I realized the man that I fell in love with because of what I heard people share at his funeral and the hundreds of people that I spoke to outside in the lobby area of the funeral home. I knew why I fell in love with him, and I'm glad. God owed me a lot, but I want to tell you one thing real quickly that happened when I was down there the first time. After the first day I was there, there was a lot of emotions going on, so I rode out to the beach for a couple of hours. Then I went back to my hotel room, and I was going to go to dinner. I'm showered, I get dressed, put some makeup on, I'm getting ready to go to dinner, and all of a sudden God said, "The story in the big book, the scotch and milk." And I was like, "What? I didn't drink scotch and milk." And God said, "Read the story." And I read the story. And I said, "Don't leave the room, Joanna. Don't leave the hotel room." I called a girlfriend of mine outside of the fellowship, and I told her. She goes, "Joanna, don't leave the room." She said, "Is there any snacks down in the lobby?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Go to the lobby. Keep me on the phone. Go to the lobby." I went to the lobby. They had a little refrigerator thing. I bought a frozen meal, you know, got some sleepy time, hot tea, and went back upstairs to the room. I stayed on the phone with this girl for an hour, ate my meal, drank my sleepy time tea, and I said, "Okay, I'm ready to go to sleep now." Now, why did that story come to mind? I'd never thought about that story before. But that story came to mind. I believe that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. The emotions were just rampant. I wasn't thinking about taking a drink, but chances are I was going to go to a restaurant that had a bar. You know, chances are I was going to probably go to a Longhorn or whatever that was nearby the hotel, and I'm sure they probably sold alcohol. And it's those God moments like that. Another real quick one, me and a few folks in the program went to the cabin back in November, and I had been telling them that the Native Americans in Canada had given some elk to the Cherokee Indians. And I see them when I go up to these Native American events, because there's a particular place that the elders showed me to go to see them. And so the night before we went rode over to Cherokee, I prayed and I just said, "God, if it's your will, let us see the elk tomorrow in Cherokee," you know. So we go, we spend the whole day in Cherokee, we're going on a picnic at the end of the day, and we turn right. My friend says, "Turn right, we'll go to the picnic spot on the river." So we turn right, and I go, "Hey, is it okay if I go back in the other direction? Let's go back in the other direction towards town." So I turned around, went back towards town, and went to a picnic spot right there on the left. And then we're packing up, we're throwing our trash away, and about that time they yell at me, "Joanna, look! Coming down off the mountain is a herd of elk." Now, if we would have turned right and stayed at that picnic place there on the right, we would have never seen them. But where we were was exactly where they came. They came right to where we were. And when I looked at that elk, you know, everybody in my group, they're standing out by the car because he's got antlers out to here, you know. And they're like, "Joanna, be careful." But there's one of those big pavilions with the picnic tables. And when I looked at that elk, this is what was revealed to me. I can do anything. Look at me. God said, "Look at me. I can do anything." That was the thought that went through my mind at that very moment. And right now I'm trying to get into college. Now, I have been walking through a lot of fear. I'm looking at high school transcripts. I see where my life took a turn from straight A student to missing 50 days a quarter and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. And it's been bringing up a lot of emotions, but I've been putting one foot in front of the other. I've gotten Kennesaw State University all the paperwork they need. I'm getting ready in May to take the Compass test, and I'm going to do some studying or tutoring between now and when I have to take the Compass test. I'm trying to get accepted at KSU, but you know what? If I don't get accepted at KSU, I'll go to a college online initially. I'll do whatever it takes. I'll be probably 55 when I graduate, but that's okay. I'm putting one foot in front of the other, and I'll tell you where that came from. I was helping my sister clean some closets out a couple of months ago, and she's been asking me to go back to college for about 2 years now. Well, this time she was sitting there in the chair, and she looked at me and she said, "Joanna, stop what you're doing." She said, "Have you ever had the dream to walk down the aisle in your cap and gown?" And I started to cry. And I said, "Yes, for 31 years, I have dreamed about walking down the aisle in my cap and gown." When she said that, God was speaking to me through her, because she was speaking what was in my heart. How did she know that? Because God revealed it to her. And those are the kind of God moments today that I ask for. I ask God to show me. I'll be in my garden that I put in, that I yelled at my first sponsor when I first started that process, and I'll see a beautiful flower, and I'll say, God, reveal to me more than just what I see in that flower. And all of a sudden, God will show me down the stem, cross across the mulch. God will show me the entire process. It might be a snail. It might be a bug of some kind. God shows me the entire process of it. The beauty is in the flower, but God's beauty is in everything that led up to that flower. And it's those little things. It's that single blade of grass that looks to you in a way that you've never seen it before. That's God, I believe. I believe God is in all of us. I believe that God speaks through us, He acts through us, and He needs us to help show love. And it's love for me today, and it's forgiveness. Because in forgiving other people, I can begin to forgive myself. And I really appreciate it. It's an honor to be here and to be telling my story again. Thanks, everybody.